At the end, the CSIs interrogate the suspects, and the suspects always crack in the face of cold, hard evidence. None of this is happening the way I planned it to. Or maybe it's just that my plan is working a little too well. I never meant to hurt Jess, and that's why the next question spears me like a javelin. Then how did her tooth get knocked out? Detective Mattson asks. I watch it unfolding in front of me, an instant invisible replay. Lugging Jess down the stairs, dropping her on the final riser, "I'm sorry," I had cried, even though that was not necessary. She couldn't hear me anymore. Whatever words I'm using, though, are falling short, since Detective Mattson doesn't understand me. So I decide to take a drastic step, to show him the inside of my mind right here and right now. I take a deep breath, and then I stare directly into his eyes. It's like having strips of my skin pulled off from the inside, like needles in every nerve center of the brain. God, it hurts. "That was an accident," I whisper. "But I saved it. I put it in her pocket." Another truth, but one that makes him jump in his seat. I'm sure he can hear my pulse as loudly as I can. That's a sign of arrhythmia. I hope I do not die right here in Detective Mattson's office. My eyes slide to his left, his right, and then up, anywhere so that I don't have to see him directly again. That's when I notice the clock and realize that it's 4:17. Without any traffic, it takes 16 minutes to get from the police station to my house. That means we will not get home until 4:33, and Crime Busters begins at 4:30. I stand up, both of my hands fluttering in front of my chest like hummingbirds. But I don't even care anymore about trying to stop them. It feels like the moment on the TV show when the perp finally caves in and falls to the metal table, sobbing with guilt. I want to be watching that TV show instead of living it. "Are we done now?" I ask. "Because I really have to go." Detective Mattson gets up, and I think he might open the door for me, but instead he blocks my exit and leans closer, until he's too close for me to breathe, because what if I wind up with some of the air that he exhaled? "Did you know you fractured her skull?" he says. "Did that happen at the same time you knocked out her tooth?" I close my eyes. "I don't know." "What about her underwear? You put it on backward, didn't you?" At that, my head whips up. "It was on backward?" How was I supposed to know? There were no labels, like there are in my boxer shorts. Shouldn't the graphic of the butterfly have gone on the front rather than back? "Did you take her underwear off her, too?" "No, you just said it was on her." "Did you try to have sex with her, Jacob?" the detective asks. I am utterly silent. Just thinking about that makes my tongue swell up like a monkey's fist knot. "Answer me, goddammit," he yells. I scramble for words, any words, because I don't want him to yell at me again. I'll tell him that I had sex with Jess 80 times that night if that's what he needs to hear, if that makes him open the door. "You moved her after she died, Jacob, didn't you?" "Yes, of course I moved her." "Isn't that obvious?" "Why?" "I needed to set up the crime scene, and that's where she had to be." He, of all people, should understand. Detective Mattson tilts his head. "Is that why you did this? You wanted to commit a crime and see if you could get away with it?" "No, that's not why." "Then what is?" he interrupts. I try to find a way to put into words all the reasons I've done what I did. But if there is one subject I don't understand, not internally, much less externally, It's the ties that bind us to each other. Love means never having to say you're sorry, I mutter. Is this a joke to you? Some big joke? Because I don't see it that way. A girl's dead, and there's nothing funny about that. He comes closer, until his arm is brushing mine, and I can barely concentrate because of the buzzing in my head. Tell me, Jacob, he says. Tell me why you killed Jess. Suddenly, the door slams open, striking him in the shoulder. Don't answer that, a strange man yells. Behind him stands my mother, and behind her are two uniformed officers who have just raced down the hall, too. Who the hell are you? Detective Mattson asks. I'm Jacob's attorney. Oh, really? He says. Jacob, is this your lawyer? I glance at the man. He's wearing khaki pants and a dress shirt, but no tie. He has sandy hair that reminds me of Theo's and looks too young to be a real lawyer. No, I reply. The detective smiles triumphantly. He's 18 years old, counselor. He says you're not his lawyer and he hasn't asked for one. I'm not stupid. I've watched enough crime busters to know where this is headed. I want a lawyer, I announce. Detective Mattson throws up his hands. We're leaving now. My mother elbows her way closer. I reach for my coat, which is still draped over the back of the chair. Mr. What's your name? The detective asks. Bond, my new lawyer says. Oliver Bond. He grins at me. Mr. Bond, your client is being charged with the murder of Jessica Ogilvie, Detective Mattson says. He's not going anywhere. Case 5. The Not-So-Good Doctor. Kay Sybers was 52 years old and, by anyone's standards, unhealthy. She'd been a smoker years ago. She was overweight. But she didn't show signs of medical problems until one evening in 1991, when, after a dinner of prime rib and Chardonnay, she had trouble breathing and developed shooting pain down her left arm. Those are classic signs of a heart attack, something her husband, Bill, should have recognized. After all, he was a Florida physician who doubled as the county coroner. Instead of calling an ambulance or whisking her to the ER, though, he attempted to draw blood from her arm. He wanted to run a few tests that day at work, he said. Yet, hours later, Kay was dead. Concluding that she had died from a coronary, Bill Sybers decided against an autopsy. A day later, based on an anonymous tip of suspicious activity, Kay Sybers was scheduled for autopsy. The toxicology reports came back inconclusive, and Kay was buried. However, suspicions arose again when rumors circulated that Bill Sybers was sleeping with a lab technician at his workplace. Kay's body was exhumed, and forensic toxicologist Kevin Ballard screened for succinylcholine, a drug that increases the release of potassium and paralyzes the muscles, including the diaphragm. In the tissues, he discovered succinyl monocholine, a byproduct of succinylcholine, and proof of the poison's presence in Kay's body. Ironically, although Bill Sybers seemed in a hurry to bury his wife and hide the evidence, the embalming process helped preserve the succinyl monocholine and made it easier to detect.
Chapter 5. Rich. The minute after I arrest Jacob Hunt, all hell breaks loose. His mother cries out and starts shouting at the same moment that I put my hand on Jacob's shoulder to lead him back to the room where we do our fingerprints and mugshots. But from his reaction, you would have thought I'd just run him through with a sword. He takes a swing at me, which sets off his lawyer, who, being a lawyer, is no doubt already wondering how to keep his client from being charged for assault on an officer as well.
"Jacob!" his mother shrieks, and then she grabs my arm. "Don't touch him! He doesn't like to be touched!"
I gingerly test my jaw where he's decked me. "Yeah, well, I don't like to be punched," I mutter, and I twist Jacob's arms behind his back and handcuff him. "I need to type up some paperwork for your son. Then we'll drive him down to the courthouse for his arraignment."
"He can't handle all this," Emma argues. "At least let me stay with him, so that he knows it's going to be all right."
"You can't," I say flatly.
"You wouldn't interrogate someone deaf without an interpreter."
"With all due respect, ma'am, your son isn't deaf." I meet her gaze. "If you don't leave, I'm going to arrest you as well." "Emma," the lawyer murmurs, taking her arm.
"Let go of me,"
she says, shaking him off. She takes a step toward her flailing son, but one of the other officers stops her. "Get them out of here," I order as I start to drag Jacob down the hall to the processing room. It's like trying to wrestle a bull into the back seat of a car. "Look," I say, "you just have to relax." But he's still struggling against my hold when I finally shove him into the small space. There's a fingerprinting machine in there, plus the camera we use for mugshots. Expensive equipment that, in my mind's eye, I'm seeing shattered by Jacob's tantrum. "Stand here," I say, pointing to a white line on the floor. "Look at the camera." Jacob lifts up his face and closes his eyes. "Open them," I say. He does, and rolls them toward the ceiling. After a minute, I take the damn picture anyway, and then his profile shots. It's when he's turned to his right that he notices the fingerprint machine and goes very still.
"Is that a live scan?"
Jacob murmurs, the first coherent words he's said since I placed him under arrest. "Yep." I stand at the keypad and suddenly realize that there is a much easier way to go about processing Jacob. "You want to see how it works?" It's like a switch has been flipped. The crazed tornado has morphed into a curious kid. He takes a step closer.
"They're digital files, right?"
"Yeah." I type Jacob's name onto the keypad. "What's your middle initial?"
"B."
"Date of birth?"
"December 21st, 1991,
he says. "You wouldn't happen to know your social security?" He rattles off a string of numbers, looking over my shoulder at the next entry.
"Weight, 185 pounds.
Jacob says, growing more animated.
"Occupation, student. Place of birth, Burlington, Vermont."
I reach for a bottle of Cornhuskers lotion that we use to make sure the ridges are slightly damp and all friction skin is captured, and realize Jacob's hands are still cuffed behind him. "I'd like to show you how this machine operates," I say slowly, "but I can't do it if you're in handcuffs."
"Right, I understand," Jacob says,
but he's staring at the screen on the live scan machine. And I think if I'd told him that he'd have to give up one of his limbs in return for seeing the scan in action, he would have eagerly agreed. I unlock the cuffs and wipe his fingertips down with the lotion before taking his right hand in mine. "First, we do the thumb flats," I say, pressing Jacob's down one at a time. "Then we do flats on the fingers." It's a simultaneous impression, the four fingers of each hand pressed on the glass surface at once. Once the computer's got these loaded, the other images are matched up against them. "You roll side to side, thumbs inward, fingers outward," I say, illustrating with the first of his fingers and following through with the rest. When the machine rejects one of the rolled fingers, Jacob's eyebrows shoot up.
"That is remarkable," he says. "It won't enter a shoddy print?"
"Nope. It lets me know when I've lifted the finger too soon or if the print is too dark, so I can redo the scan." When I finish with his fingers, I press his palm flat on the surface. It's the type of print we find most often on windows, if a criminal's been peeking inside,
and then I scan a writer's palm print, the curved edge of the hand along the pinky finger down to the wrist. By the time I switch to Jacob's left hand, he's practically doing it himself. "It's that easy," I say, as the images line up on the screen.
"So you'll send out searches to Aethys right from here?" Jacob asks.
"That's the plan." Having a digital live scan that connects to the automated fingerprint identification system is a godsend. I'm old enough to remember when it was far more complicated than it is now. The prints are sent to the State Central Depository, which documents the arrest and sends it along to the FBI. After I lock Jacob up, I will come back to see if there are any other crimes in his past for which he has a record. I'm guessing there will not be any other hits, but that doesn't mean this is the first time Jacob's acted out. It only means it's the first time he's been caught. The printer spits out a card that I'll put in his arrest folder, along with his mugshots. At the top, all of Jacob's biographical information is listed. Below are 10 small squares, each with a rolled print. Under those are the 10 fingerprint digits, lined up like an army of soldiers. In that instant, I happen to notice Jacob's face. His eyes are shining. His mouth is bent into a smile. He's been arrested for murder, yet he's on Cloud 9, because he's gotten to see a live scan system up close and personal. I hit a button, and a second card is printed. "Here," I hand it to him. He starts to bounce on the balls of his feet.
"You mean, I can keep it?"
"Why the hell not?" I say. While he's entranced by the printout, I grasp his elbow to lead him to the lockup. This time, he doesn't go ballistic when I touch him. He doesn't even notice. Once, I was called into a suicide. The guy had OD'd on sleeping pills when he was supposed to be babysitting for his sister's twins. The kids were 10-year-old boys, holy terrors. When they couldn't wake up their uncle, they decided to horse around with him. They covered his face with whipped cream and put a cherry on his nose, which is the first thing I saw when I took a look at the body stretched out on the living room couch. Those kids never realized the guy was dead. Eventually, of course, they would have been told, and even though my work was done at that point, I thought about the twins a lot. You just know that after they found out, they were never quite the same. I was probably one of the last people to see those boys when they were still just two kids, when death was the farthest thing from their minds. That's what haunts me at night. Not the dead bodies I find, but the live ones I leave in my wake. When I lock Jacob into our holding cell, he doesn't react, and that scares me more than his earlier outburst. "I'm coming back for you," I say. "I just have to finish doing a little paperwork, and then we'll go to the courthouse, okay?" He doesn't answer. In his right hand, he clutches the fingerprint card. His left hand is flapping against his thigh. "Why don't you sit down?" I say. Instead of taking a seat on the bunk, Jacob immediately sinks down onto the concrete floor. We have a video camera pointed into the cell, so that someone is always watching over a perp. I should be going through the paperwork, which takes forever, but instead, I swing into the dispatch to stare at the monitor. For 10 whole minutes, Jacob Hunt doesn't move, unless you count the way his hand is fluttering. Then, very slowly, he scoots backward until he's leaning against the wall, pressed against the corner of the cell. His mouth is moving. "What the hell is he saying?" I ask the dispatcher.
"Beats me."
I walk out of dispatch and crack the door that leads to the holding cell. Jacob's voice is faint.
"All around in my hometown, they're trying to track me down. They say they want to bring me in guilty for the killing of a deputy."
I swing open the door and walk up to the cell. Jacob is still singing, his voice rising and falling. My footsteps echo on the concrete.
but he doesn't stop, not even when I'm standing on the other side of the bars, directly in front of him, with my arms crossed. He sings through the chorus two more times before he stops. He doesn't look at me, but I can tell from the way his shoulders square that he knows I'm here. With a sigh, I realize that I'm not going to leave this kid alone again. And I'm not going to get my paperwork done unless I can convince him it's another lesson in police procedure. So, I say, unlocking the cell door, have you ever filled out an intake form?
This ends Disc 6. House Rules, Disc 7.
Oliver. As soon as I hear the detective say that he'll arrest Emma Hunt if she doesn't shut up, I snap out of the panic I am in, the panic induced by the sentence he spoke just slightly before that. Then we'll drive him down to the courthouse for his arraignment. What the hell do I know about arraignments? I have won a couple of civil suits, but a criminal arraignment is a whole different animal. We are in Emma's car, driving to the courthouse, but that was a struggle. She didn't want to leave the police station without Jacob. The only way I managed to convince her to leave was by pointing her in the direction of where her son would be heading. I ought to be with him, she says, running a red light. I'm his mother, for God's sake. As if that triggers something else in her mind, she grimaces. Theo. Oh my God, Theo. He doesn't even know we're here. I don't know who Theo is, and to be honest, I don't have time to care. I'm busy wondering where I'm supposed to stand in the courtroom. What do I say? Do I speak first, or does the prosecutor? This is a total misunderstanding, Emma insists. Jacob's never hurt anyone. This couldn't be his fault. Actually, I don't even know which courtroom to go to. Are you even listening? Emma asks, and I realize at that moment she must have asked me a question. Yes, I say, figuring I have a 50% chance of being right. She narrows her eyes. Left or right? She repeats. We are sitting at a stop sign. Left, I murmur. What happens at the arraignment? She asks. Jacob won't have to talk, will he? No, the lawyer does. I mean, I do. The whole point of an arraignment is just to read the charges and set bail. This much I remember from law school, anyway. But it's not the right thing to say to Emma. Bail? She repeats. They're going to lock Jacob up? I don't know, I say, totally honest. Let's cross that bridge when we come to it. Emma parks in the courthouse lot. When will he get here? I don't know the answer to that. What I do know is that it's nearly the end of the business day, and if Detective Mattson doesn't get his ass in gear, Jacob's going to be spending the night at the county jail. But there's no way I'm going to tell Emma that. It's quiet inside the courthouse. Most of the cases are through for the day. However, mine is just beginning. And I need a crash course in criminal law before my client figures out I'm a total fraud. Why don't you wait here, I suggest, pointing to a chair in the lobby. Where are you going? To do, some paperwork that needs to be filed before Jacob arrives, I say, trying to look as confident as possible. And then I make a beeline for the office of the clerk. Just like nurses in a hospital tend to know more than the doctors most of the time, if you really want to get the answer to a question about court, you should spend more time buttering up the clerks than the judges. Hello, I say to the small, dark-haired woman peering into a computer screen. I'm here for a criminal arraignment. She flicks a glance upward. How nice for you, she says flatly. My gaze falls on a nameplate on her desk. I wonder, Dorothy, if you could tell me in which courtroom that might take place? The criminal courtroom would be a safe bet. Right, I smile, as if I knew this all along. And the judge? If it's Monday, it's Judge Cuttings, she says. Thanks. Thanks very much, I reply. Really nice to meet you. The highlight of my day, Dorothy intones. I'm about to walk out the door when I turn back at the last moment. One more thing. Yes. Am I supposed to say anything? She looks up from her computer. The judge will ask you whether your client pleads guilty or not guilty, Dorothy answers. Great, I say. I really appreciate that. In the lobby, I find Emma hanging up her cell phone. So? She asks. I sink into the empty seat beside her. Piece of cake, I tell her, and I hope I can convince myself. Emma and I sit through three drug possession charges, one B&E, and an indecent exposure charge before Jacob is brought into the courtroom. From my vantage point in the gallery, I can tell the moment Emma notices he's here, she sits up a little straighter, and her breath catches in her throat. If you have spent any time in a courtroom, you know that high school football players, the mean ones with no necks, grow up and become bailiffs. Two of these behemoths are manhandling Jacob, who's doing his damnedest to get the hell away from them. He keeps craning his neck, looking at the people in the courtroom, and as soon as he spots Emma, his entire body sags with relief. I stand up, heading down from the gallery because it's showtime, and realize too late that Emma's following me. You have to stay here, I whisper over my shoulder as I take my place at the defendant's table beside my client. Hi, I say to Jacob under my breath. My name's Oliver. Your mom hired me to be your lawyer, and I've got it all under control. Don't say anything to the judge. Just let me do the talking. The whole time I'm speaking, Jacob is looking at his lap. The minute I finish, he twists in his seat. Mom, he calls out. What's going on? Counselor, the bigger bailiff says. Either shut your client up or he's going back in the holding cell. I just told you not to talk to anybody, I tell Jacob. You told me not to say anything to the judge. You can't talk to anybody, I clarify. Do you understand? Jacob glances down at the table. Jacob? Hello? You told me not to talk to anybody, he mutters. Will you make up your mind already? Judge Cuttings is a hard-boiled New Englander who, in his time off, runs a llama farm and who, in my opinion, looks a little like a llama himself. He has just announced Jacob's name when Dorothy the clerk enters through a side door and passes him a note. Looking down his long nose at it, he sighs. I have two arraignments for Mr. Robichaud that need to be done in another courtroom. Since he's currently here with his clients, I'll do those first, and then we'll take the prisoner's case. The minute he says the word prisoner, Jacob jumps to his feet. I need a sensory break, he announces. Shut up, I murmur. I need a sensory break. Dozens of thoughts are running through my mind. How do I get the kid to stop talking? How do I get the judge to forget everything that's unfolding before his eyes? How would a seasoned lawyer handle a situation like this when a client becomes a loose cannon? How long before I am seasoned enough to stop second-guessing myself? The minute Jacob takes a step, the two bailiffs are on top of him. He starts screaming, a high, keening sound. Let go of him, Emma shrieks behind me. He doesn't understand. He's allowed to get up in school when things are overwhelming. This isn't school, the judge thunders. This is my courtroom, and you, madam, will be leaving it. The second bailiff releases Jacob and steps into the gallery to pull Emma outside. I can explain, she cries, but her voice gets fainter as she's forced down the aisle. I look from her to my client, who has gone boneless and is being dragged out a different door. Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape, Jacob yells. The judge narrows his eyes at me. It's from Planet of the Apes? I mutter. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore, he replies. That's from Network. I highly recommend you watch the movie after you get your client under control. I duck my head and hurry down the aisle. Emma stands outside the courtroom door, flushed and angry, her eyes shooting daggers at the bailiff. Your kid can wait until the courtroom's empty, he says to me. That's when we'll arraign him. And the mother can't come back inside until then. He enters the courtroom again. The door opens with a gasp. That leaves me standing alone in the hallway with Emma, who grabs my hand and pulls me toward the staircase. What are you doing? He's down there, isn't he? Come on. Hold it. I dig in my heels and fold my arms. What was that all about? I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so. That's Asperger's. Sometimes Jacob seems totally normal, brilliant even. and sometimes the tiniest thing can set him off into a full-fledged fit. Well, he can't behave like that in a courtroom. I thought he knew all about crime scenes and cops and the law. He has to be respectful and quiet, or this will be disastrous. He's trying, Emma insists. That's why he asked for a sensory break. A what? A place he can go to away from all the noise and confusion, so that he can calm himself down. At school, that's one of the special accommodations he gets. Look, can we talk about this later and just go see him? Jacob was getting his sensory break in a holding cell. You aren't allowed down there. She flinches as if I've struck her. Well, Emma says, are you? To be honest, I am not sure. I poke my head inside the courtroom. The bailiff stands just inside the door, arms folded. Can I go talk to my client? I whisper. Yeah, he says. Go ahead. I wait for him to take me to Jacob, but he doesn't budge. Thanks, I say, and I duck out the door again and head past Emma down the stairs. I hope that's where the holding cells are. After 5 minutes of detours through the custodial closet and the boiler room, I find what I'm looking for. Jacob is sitting in the corner of the cell, one hand flapping like a bird, his shoulders hunched, his voice thready and singing Bob Marley. How come you sing that song? I ask, coming to stand in front of the bars. He pauses in the middle of the chorus. It makes me feel better. I consider this. You know any Dylan? When he doesn't answer, I step forward. Look, Jacob, I know you don't know what's going on, and to be honest, neither do I. I've never done this before, but we're going to figure it out together. All you have to do is promise me one thing. Let me do the talking. I wait for Jacob to nod, to acknowledge me, but it doesn't happen. Do you trust me? No, he says. I don't. Then he gets to his feet. Will you give a message to my mom? Sure. He curls his hands around the bars. His fingers are long, elegant. Life is like a box of chocolates, he whispers. You never know what you're gonna get. I laugh, thinking the boy can't be all that bad off if he's able to joke around. But then I realize that he's not kidding. I'll tell her, I say. When I return, Emma is pacing. Is he okay? She asks the minute I turn the corner. Was he responsive? Yes and yes, I assure her. Maybe Jacob's stronger than you think he is. You're basing this insight on the 5 minutes you've spent with him? She rolls her eyes. He has to eat by 6. If he doesn't, I'll get him a snack from the vending machines. It can't have caseins or glutens. I have no freaking idea what that means. Emma, you have to relax. She rounds on me. My older son, who's autistic, has just been arrested for murder. He's stuck in a jail cell somewhere in the basement, for God's sake. Don't you dare tell me to relax. Well, it won't do Jacob any good if you lose it in the courtroom again. When she doesn't respond, I sit down on a bench across the hall. He wanted me to tell you something. The hope on her face is so naked that I have to look away. Life is like a box of chocolates, I quote. With a sigh, Emma sinks down beside me. Forrest Gump. That's one of his favorites. Movie buff? An intense one. It's almost like he's studying for a test he'll have to take later. She glances at me. When he feels something overwhelming, he doesn't always have the words for it, so he quotes someone else's. I think about Jacob spouting Charlton Heston when the bailiff grabbed him and smiled broadly. He sets up crime scenes for me, Emma says softly, so that I can look at the forensic evidence and work backward. But I should have been working forward. We never really talked about what happens after, what happens now. I know you're upset, but we have a lot of time to figure it out. Today's arraignment is just a rubber stamp. She stares at me. When I was in college, the girls that I always found myself drooling over or the ones who had dabs of toothpaste on their chins, or who stuck pencils through their messy hair to keep it away from their faces. The ones who slayed me were so far removed from caring how they looked that they circled back to a natural, artless beauty. Emma Hunt might be a decade older than me, but she's still a knockout. "How old are you?" she asks after a moment. "I don't really think that chronological age is a decent measure of 24, she guesses. 28. She closes her eyes and shakes her head. "I was 28 1,000 years ago." "Then you look great for your age," I say. Blinking, she focuses fiercely on me. "Promise," she demands. "Promise me that you're going to get my son out of here." I nod at her, and for a moment, I want to be a white knight. I want to be able to tell her I know law as well as I know how to shoe a skittish mare, and I don't want it to be a lie. Just then, the bailiff peers around the corner. "We're ready," he says. I only wish I could say the same. The courtroom is different when it's empty. Dust motes hang in the air, and my footsteps sound like gunshots on the parquet flooring. Emma and I walk to the front of the gallery, where I leave her sitting just behind the bar as I cross through to sit at the defense table. It's deja vu. Jacob is led out by the bailiffs. He's handcuffed, and I hear Emma suck in her breath behind me when she notices. But then again, he left the courtroom violent. There's no reason to assume he wouldn't pull the same trick twice. When he sits down beside me, the handcuffs jingle in his lap. He presses his lips together in a flat line, as if he's trying to show me he remembers my instructions. "All rise," the bailiff says, and when I stand up, I grab Jacob's sleeve so he will too. Judge Cuttings enters and sits down heavily in his chair, his robes billowing around him like a storm. "I trust you've talked to your client about his behavior in the courtroom, counselor?" "Yes, Your Honor," I answer. "I'm sorry about the outburst. Jacob's autistic." The judge frowns. "Are you concerned about competency?" "Yes," I reply. "All right, Mr. Bond. Your client is here to be arraigned on a charge of first-degree murder pursuant to 13 VSA, section 2301. Do you waive the reading of the rights on his behalf at this time?"
"Yes, Your Honor."
He nods. "Going to enter a not guilty plea on his behalf because of the competency issue?" For a moment, I hesitate. If the judge enters the plea, does that mean I don't have to? "Are there any other issues with the charge as it stands today, Counselor?"
"I don't think so, Your Honor."
"Excellent. This is bound over for a competency hearing 14 days from today at 9 a.m. I'll see you then, Mr. Bond."
The larger bailiff approaches the defense table and hauls Jacob to his feet. He lets loose a squeak, and then, remembering the rules of the courtroom, squelches it.
"Hang on a minute," I interrupt. "Judge, didn't you just say we could go?"
"I said you could go, Counselor. Your client, on the other hand, is charged with murder and being held pending his competency hearing at your own request."
As he leaves the bench to return to chambers, as Jacob is pulled out of the courtroom again, silent this time, headed to a 2-week stay in jail, I gather the courage to turn around and confess to Emma Hunt that I've just done everything I told her I wouldn't.
Theo. My mother doesn't cry very often. The first time, like I said, was at the library when I had a tantrum instead of Jacob. The second time was when I was 10 years old and Jacob was 13, and he had homework for his life skills class, an extracurricular he hated because he was one of only 2 autistic kids, and the other boy didn't have AS but was lower on the spectrum and spent most of the class lining up crayons end to end. The other 3 kids in the class had Down syndrome or developmental disabilities. Because of this, a lot of time was spent on things like hygiene, stuff Jacob already knew how to do, with a little bit of social skills tossed in. And one day, his teacher assigned the class to make a friend before the next time they all met.
You don't make a friend, Jacob said with a scowl. It's not like they come with directions like you'd find on a box of macaroni and cheese. All you have to do is remember the steps that Mrs. Le Fay gave you, my mother said. Look someone in the eye, tell them your name, ask them if they'd like to play. Even at 10, I knew that this protocol would surely lead to getting your ass kicked. But I wasn't going to tell Jacob that. So the three of us trekked to the local playground, and I sat down next to my mother on a bench while Jacob set out to make a friend. The problem was, there was no one his age there. The oldest kid I could see was about my age, and he was hanging upside down from the monkey bars. Jacob walked up to him and twisted sideways so that he could look the kid in the eye. My name is Jacob, he said in his voice, which I'm used to, but which is weird to everyone else, flat as a sheet of aluminum, even in places where there should be exclamation points. Do you want to play? The kid did a neat flip onto the ground. Are you like some kind of retard? Jacob considered this. No? Newsflash, the boy said. You are. The kid ran off, leaving Jacob standing alone under the monkey bars. I almost got up to rescue him, but then he started to turn in a slow circle. I couldn't figure out what he was doing, and then I realized he liked the sound his sneaker made when it crunched a dry leaf underneath the sole. He walked on his tiptoes, very precisely crushing the leaves until he reached the sandbox. A pair of tiny kids, one blonde and one with red pigtails, were busy making pizzas out of sand. Here's another one, the first girl said, and she slapped a glob of sand onto the wooden railing so that the other girl could decorate it with pepperoni rocks and mozzarella grass. Hi, I'm Jacob, my brother said. I'm Annika, and I'm going to be a unicorn when I grow up, the blonde said. Pigtails didn't look up from the pizza assembly line. My little brother threw up in the bathroom and slipped in it and landed on his butt. Do you want to play? Jacob asked. We could dig for dinosaurs. There aren't any dinosaurs in the sandbox, just pizza, Annika said. Maggie's the one who gets to put on the cheese and stuff, but you can be the waiter. Jacob looked like a giant in the sandbox beside those two girls. A woman was staring daggers at him, and I would have bet $50 it was either Annika's or Maggie's mom, wondering if the 13-year-old playing with her precious little daughter was a perv. Jacob picked up a stick and began to outline a skeleton in the sand. The Allosaurus had a wishbone, like other meat-eating dinosaurs, he said, just like you'd find on a chicken. Here's another one, Annika said, and she dumped a pile of sand in front of Maggie. You could practically draw a line between the little girls and Jacob. They weren't playing together as much as they were playing next to each other. Jacob looked up at that moment and grinned at me. He tipped his head toward the girls as if to say, Hey, check it out. I made two friends. I glanced at my mother, and that's when I saw her crying. Tears were rolling down her cheeks, and she wasn't doing anything to try to wipe them away. It was almost as if she didn't know what was happening. There were plenty of other times in my life that it would have made more sense for my mother to cry, when she had to go to the school to talk to the principal about something Jacob had done to get himself into trouble, for example, or when he had one of his tantrums in the middle of a crowded space, like last year, in front of the Santa Claus Pavilion at the mall, while a bazillion kids and parents watched the nuclear meltdown ensue. But then, my mother had been dry-eyed, her face wiped clean of expression. In fact, during those moments, my mother looked a little like Jacob did. I don't know why seeing my brother with two little girls in a sandbox was a straw that broke the so-called camel's back for her. I just know that at that moment, I remember feeling like the world had turned itself inside out.
It's the child who's supposed to cry, and the mom who makes it all better, not the other way around. Which is why mothers will move heaven and earth to hold it together in front of their own kids. Even then, I knew that if Jacob was the one who made her cry, I was the one who had to stop it. Of course, I know where they are. My mother has called me from the courthouse. But that doesn't keep me from being unable to concentrate on Civitas or Geo until they come home. I wonder if my teachers will accept that as an excuse. Sorry I didn't get my homework done. My brother was being arraigned. Sure, my geometry teacher will say, like I haven't heard that one 1,000 times. The minute I hear the door open, I run into the mudroom to find out what happened. My mother walks in, alone, and sits down on the bench where we usually dump our school backpacks. Where's Jacob? I ask. And very slowly, she looks up at me. In jail, she whispers. Oh my God. He's in jail. She bends at the waist until she's doubled over. Mom? I touch her shoulder, but she doesn't move. It scares me to death, and it's eerily familiar. It takes me a second to place it, the way she's staring off into space, the way she won't respond. This is how Jacob looked last week, when we couldn't get him to come back to us. Come on, Mom. I slip my arm around her waist and lift her. She feels like a bag of bones. I guide her upstairs, wondering why the hell Jacob is in jail. Aren't you supposed to be guaranteed the right to a speedy trial? Could it have been that speedy? If only I'd done my Civitas homework, maybe I'd understand what had happened. But this much I know. I'm not about to ask my mother. I sit down on the bed, and then I kneel and take off her shoes. Just lie down, I suggest, which seems like something she'd say if the tables were turned. I'll get you a cup of tea, okay? In the kitchen, I set the kettle to boil and have a tsunami of deja vu. The last time I did this, boil a kettle, take out a tea bag, and hook its paper tag over the edge of a mug, I was in Jess Ogilvie's house. It's really just a matter of luck that Jacob's the one sitting in jail right now, and I'm here. It could easily have been the other way around. Part of me is relieved about that, which makes me feel like total crap. I wonder what the detective said to Jacob. Why my mother brought him down there in the first place. Maybe that's why she's so messed up now. Not grief, but guilt. That much I understand. If I'd gone to the cops and told them I'd seen Jess alive and naked earlier that day, would it have made matters worse for Jacob or better? I don't really know how my mother takes her tea, so I put in milk and sugar and carry it upstairs. She's sitting up now, the pillows piled behind her. When she sees me, she tears up. My boy, she says as I sit down beside her. She cups her hand around my cheek. My beautiful boy. She might be talking about me, and she might be talking about Jacob. I decide it doesn't really matter. Mom, I ask, what's going on? Jacob has to stay in jail for 2 weeks. Then they'll take him to court again to see if he's competent to stand trial. Okay, I may not be a rocket scientist, but sticking someone who may not be able to handle a trial in jail doesn't seem like the best way to see if they're able to handle a trial. I mean, if you can't handle a trial, how the hell could you handle jail? But he hasn't done anything wrong, I say, and I look carefully at my mother to see if she knows more than I do. If she does, she's not showing it. That doesn't seem to matter. Today, in Civitas, we talked about the cornerstone of our country's legal system. That you're innocent until proven guilty. Locking someone up in jail while you try to figure out what to do next
doesn't seem like you're giving him the benefit of the doubt. It sounds like you're already assuming he's screwed, so he might as well get comfortable in his future living quarters. My mother tells me how Jacob got suckered into talking to the detective, how she ran to find him a lawyer, how Jacob was arrested in front of her, how he decked the bailiffs when they tried to grab his arms. I don't understand why this lawyer wasn't able to get Jacob released and back home. I read enough Grisham novels to know that happens all the time, especially for people who don't have a previous record. So what happens now? I ask. I don't just mean for Jacob, either. I mean for us. All those years I wished Jacob didn't exist, and now that he's not in the house, it's like there's an elephant in the room. How am I supposed to make a can of soup for dinner knowing that my brother is in a cell somewhere? How am I supposed to get up in the morning, go to school, pretend that this is life as usual? Oliver, that's the lawyer, says that people get unarrested all the time. The police get some new evidence, and they let the original suspect go. She's holding on to this like it's a lucky charm, a rabbit's foot, an amulet. Jacob will be unarrested, and we can all go back to the way we were. Never mind that the way we were wasn't that terrific, or that unarrested doesn't mean the slate is wiped entirely clear so you forget what happened. Imagine spending 20 years in prison for a crime you never committed before you're acquitted thanks to DNA evidence. Sure, you're free now, but you don't get back those 20 years. You don't ever stop being that guy who used to be in prison. Because I don't know how to say this to her, and I'm sure she doesn't want to hear it anyway. I reach for the remote control on her nightstand and turn on the TV that's sitting on the dresser across the room. The news is on, the weatherman predicting a storm sometime next week. Thanks, Norm, the anchorwoman says. Breaking news in the case of the murder of Jessica Ogilvy. Police have arrested 18-year-old Jacob Hunt of Townsend, Vermont, in connection with the crime. Beside me, my mother freezes. Jacob's school photo fills the screen. In it, he's wearing a striped blue shirt and, as usual, not staring at the camera. Jacob is a senior at Townsend Regional High School and was tutored by the victim. Holy shit. We'll have more on this story as it develops, the anchor promises. My mother lifts the remote control. I figure she's going to turn off the television, but instead, she hurls it at the screen. The remote breaks apart and the TV screen cracks. She rolls onto her side. I'll get the broom, I say. In the middle of the night, I hear noises in the kitchen. I creep downstairs to find my mother rummaging through a drawer to find the phone book. Her hair is loose, her feet are bare, and there's a toothpaste stain on her shirt. Why isn't it listed under government? She mutters. What are you doing? I have to call the jail, she says. He doesn't like it when it's dark. I could bring him a nightlight. I want them to know that I can bring him a nightlight if that helps. Mom, I say. She picks up the telephone. Mom, you need to go to bed. No, she corrects. I need to call the jail. It's 3 a.m. They're asleep. I look at her. Jacob's asleep. She turns her face to mine. Do you really think so? Yeah, I say. But the word has to squeeze itself out around the knot in my throat. Yeah, I do. Here are the things I'm afraid of. That the subject Jacob loves the most has stopped being an interest and has started to become an obsession. That this is why he's in jail in the first place. That when he was last with Jess, something made him feel scared or cornered, which is what makes him snap. That you can love someone and hate him at the same time.
that age has nothing to do with who is the older brother. If you think having a brother who's got Asperger's makes me a pariah, imagine having one who's in jail. The next day I'm in school. Yes, more on that later. And everywhere I go, I hear the whispers. I heard he cut off her finger with a knife and kept it. I heard he hit her with a baseball bat. I always thought he was creepy. The reason I'm taking up space in my classes today, and believe me, that's all I'm doing, since my brain is too busy blocking the gossip I overhear, is that my mother thought it was the best plan. I have to go to the jail, she said, which I had figured would happen. You can't stay home for 2 weeks. You have to go back sometime. I knew she was right. But didn't she also realize that people were going to ask about Jacob, make assumptions, and not just the kids? Teachers would come up to me full of fake sympathy when what they really wanted was some dirt they could take back to the teacher's lounge. The whole thing made me feel sick to my stomach. What am I supposed to say if someone asks? My mother hesitated. Tell them your brother's attorney said you can't talk about it. Is that true? I have no idea. I took a deep breath. I was going to come clean. Tell her about breaking into Jess's house. Mom, I have to talk to you about something. Can I take a rain check? She said. I want to be there when the doors open at 9. There's plenty of cereal for breakfast, and you can take the bus. Now, I'm sitting in biology next to Elise Howith, who is a pretty good lab partner even if she's a girl, when she slips a note to me. I'm really sorry to hear about your brother. I want to thank her for being nice, for being the first person to give a shit about Jacob instead of crucifying him like the media and the stupid court already have for what he's done. What he's done. I grab my backpack and run out of class, even though Mr. Jennison is still yammering away, and he doesn't even comment, which tells me more than anything that this is not my life, but a parallel universe. I keep walking down the hall without a hall pass, and no one stops me. Not when I cruise past the principal's office and the guidance department. Not when I bust through the double doors near the gym into the blinding light of afternoon and start walking. Apparently, in the public schools, if you have a relative arrested for murder, the administration and teachers pretend you're invisible. Which, to be honest, isn't really all that different from the way I was treated before. I wish I had my skateboard with me. Then I could move faster, maybe outdistance the facts that keep circling in my head. I saw Jess Ogilvie alive and well. Shortly after that, Jacob went to her house. Now she's dead. I've seen my brother put a chair through a wall and smash a window with his hand. I've been in his way sometimes when he has a meltdown. I've got the scars to prove it. You do the math. My brother is a murderer. I test the words under my breath and immediately feel a pain in my chest. You can't say it the way you'd say, my brother is 6 feet tall, or my brother likes scrambled eggs, even if they are all accurate facts. But the Jacob I knew a week ago is no different than the Jacob I saw this morning. So does that mean I was too stupid to notice some major flaw in my brother? Or that anyone, even Jacob, might suddenly turn into a person you never imagined? I sure as hell qualify. All my life I've thought I have nothing in common with my brother. And it turns out we're both criminals. But you didn't kill anyone. The voice echoes in my head, an excuse. For all I know, Jacob's got his reasons, too. That makes me run faster. But I could be a goddamn bullet and still not manage to outstrip the sad fact that I'm no better than those assholes at school. I've already assumed my brother is guilty. Behind the school, if you go far enough, you hit a pond. It's a community hotspot in the winter. On weekends, someone lights a bonfire and brings marshmallows to roast. And a few enterprising hockey dads sweep the ice with wide shovels so that pickup games can break out all across its surface. I step onto the ice, even though I don't have skates with me. It's not crowded on a weekday. A few moms with toddlers pushing milk crates as they learn to skate. An old man in those black figure skates that always make me think of Holland or the Olympics. He's doing figure eights. I dump my backpack on the edge of the snow and shuffle my feet little by little until I'm standing dead center. Every year there's a competition in Townsend to see when the ice will fully melt. They stick a pole in the ice that's attached to some kind of digital clock, and when the ice melts enough for the pole to tilt, it trips a switch and records that moment in time. People put money down on which day and hour the ice will melt, and the person with the closest guess gets the jackpot. Last year, I think it was about $4,500. What if the moment the ice melted was right now? What if I went under? Would those kids skating around hear the splash? Would the old man come to my rescue? My English teacher says a rhetorical question is one that's asked even though an answer isn't expected. Is the Pope Catholic? Or does a bear crap in the woods? I think it's a question that has an answer you don't really want to hear. Does this dress make me look fat? Are you really that stupid? If the ice melts and no one sees me go under, did I ever really exist? If I were the one in jail, would Jacob believe the worst of me? Just like that, I sit down in the middle of the pond on the ice. It's cold through my jeans. I picture myself freezing from the inside out. They'll find me, and I'll be a sculpture, a statue. Hey, kid, you okay? The old man has skated over to me. You need some help? Like I said, an answer you don't really want to hear. I didn't sleep much last night, but when I did, I dreamed. I dreamed that I was breaking Jacob out of jail. I did it by reading through all his Crime Busters notebooks and copying the behavior of cat burglars. As soon as I rounded the corner of the prison where Jacob was being kept in a cell, he was ready. Jacob, I said, you have to do exactly what I tell you to do. And he did, which is how I knew it was a dream. He was quiet, and he followed my lead, and he didn't ask any questions. We tiptoed past the guard booth, and we both hopped into a giant trash bin, covering ourselves with paper and garbage. The custodian finally came and wheeled us through the buzzers and the locked gate, and just as he was about to dump the giant trash bin into the dumpster outside, I yelled, "Now!" And Jacob and I jumped out and started running. We ran for hours, until the only things following us were falling stars. And then we finally stopped in a field of tall grass and laid down on our backs on the ground. I didn't do it, Jacob told me. I believe you, I said. And it was really true. On that day when Jacob was supposed to make a friend for homework, those two little girls he met in the sandbox had to leave. They ran off without saying goodbye, leaving my 13-year-old brother alone and digging in the sand. I was afraid to look at my mother again, so instead, I walked to the sandbox and sat down on the edge. My knees came up to my chin. I was too big for the space. It was crazy to see my brother squeezed into it. I picked up a rock and started to paw through the sand with it. What are we looking for? I asked. Allosaurus, Jacob replied. How are we going to know when we find it? Jacob's face lit up. Well, its vertebrae and skull won't be as heavy as those of other dinosaurs. That's what the name means, translated, different lizard. I imagined any kid Jacob's age watching him play paleontologist in a sandbox and wondered if he'd ever have a friend. Theo, he suddenly whispered.
You know we're not really going to find Allosaurus in here. Yeah, I laughed. But if we did, that would be some story, wouldn't it? The news vans would come, Jacob said. Screw the news. We'd be on Oprah, I told him. Two kids who find a dinosaur skeleton in a sandbox. We might even wind up on the Wheaties box. The Fabulous Hunt Brothers, Jacob grinned. That's what they'd call us. The Fabulous Hunt Brothers, I repeated. And I watched Jacob dig to the bottom with his shovel. I wondered how long it would be before I outgrew him.
Jacob. I don't really understand what's happening. At first, I thought maybe this was protocol, like the way that my mother was wheeled out of the hospital after she gave birth to Theo, even though she could easily have walked and carried him in her arms. Maybe it was a liability issue, which is why the bailiffs had to get me out of the courtroom. This time, they were a little more hesitant to touch me. I assumed they would lead me to the front of the building, or maybe to a loading dock, where defendants could be picked up and taken home. Instead, I was stuffed into the back of a police car and driven 2 hours and 38 minutes to jail. I do not want to be in jail. The officers who drop me off aren't the same ones who take me into the jail. This new one wears a different colored uniform and asks me the same questions that Detective Mattson asked me at the police station. There are fluorescent lights on the ceiling, like they have at Walmart.